With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. You're listening to The Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Everyone, in the second hour of the show, we have been campaigning across the country, as you know, with Together, working with local campaign groups, Free Our Streets, Take Back Democracy, who've been challenging impositions by local authorities and by central government around active travel and livable streets, imposing road closures, otherwise known as LTNs, low traffic neighbourhoods, as well as 15 and 20 minute city or neighbourhoods that sound good but often don't come with any service provision added, or and also include limiting on mobility and banning cars in lots of places and fining people, as well as the ULEZ and CASes, the clean air zones, the ultra low emission zones, the low emission zones in Scotland. And I'm very pleased that we've got someone now on the show who's a veteran of the nighttime industry in the Midlands. For many years has run nightclubs, including Silk, Snoopy's in Cannock. He's also been involved in lobbying for hospitality, as well as being involved in challenging some of these measures and campaigning for Together in Birmingham and elsewhere with us. It is, of course, Martin Murray. How are you doing, Martin? Thanks for joining us today.
Hi there, Alan. Doing really well, thank you.
So, I mean, Martin, just the first thing really is just tell us what happens like during lockdowns, what the impact of that to your business, if you would.
I'm slightly unique that I was about to do a major refurb, a change of business model. I was about to reinvest another $500,000 into the area. Not a huge refurb, but that's how much it costs. And just as I was starting to put the place down, ready for work to commence in February, rumours started about things happening in China, then in Italy. So I delayed the refurb. Sure enough, 2 weeks later, the world locked down. 6 years later, well, 2 years after that, we're still having restrictions on nightclubs more than any other venue. People were not allowed to dance. You still had to social distance. We had a curfew at 10 p.m. The insanity of that, it just caused greater concentration of people being together at one point in time. The total opposite effect to what they said it would cause. It killed me. It killed many nightclubs. In fact, in the last 2 years, over a third of all nightclubs have shut down in the UK. That's how bad effect it had on our industry.
And so just, I mean, one of the things that many have noticed is that the kind of measures, just for transparency, I sort of was a co-founder of the Nighttime Industry Association, its first chair, and I'd seen a lot of the impacts of the public health agenda that damaged and impacted licensed premises across the UK. And we spent 6 or 7 years winning over the police and councillors and Home Office and others. We got nighttime ambassadors appointed, and we worked with mayors and the cabinet and others, right? And we got a lot of things changed. And then lockdowns happened and these shutters came down. But part of the whole outlook was an anti-public one, as though we're all kind of infectors. We're all vectors of antisocial behaviour. Anything we do together is to be distrusted. It's got kind of predatory aims or nastiness, rather than the great transformations in the economy, the way it shapes the music industry, fashion, our great global exports, tourism, why people come and move into areas, it lights things up, whether that's in Midlands, Manchester, Liverpool, or in London, in areas that have been very run down. All of those things have been fantastic. And yet, often it's at the cutting edge of being blamed for things, right, in terms of, because it's dealing with the public all the time and it's got alcohol as well. And the whole idea of, this has been along for many centuries, the idea of the public as not to be trusted with alcohol and with enjoyment and with its leisure time. And then it seemed like that, like with the whole response to COVID was very much like that as well, that the public is not to be trusted and that we need to like instruct them. All the people that volunteered were ignored and we were locked away. And I don't know what you think, but it just seems there's a lot of similarities in that between the whole way local authorities and the government have been treating us in terms of these traffic measures. There's a new emergency, permanent crisis, do as you're told. This is what needs to happen to you, rather than a kind of public debate about how best we can work out things and also what the damage to business is going to be and to residents. There seems to be a kind of cavalier disdain, a dislike, not even disdain, it's disregard. They don't, like when you shut down roads and delivery vans and people picking up people, that they don't consider what the consequences are for that.
It's fear of the crowd. Fear the crowd. Wherever people congregate, that must be bad. You touch each other, you breathe on each other, you will kill each other. The rhetoric that was broadcast by every single media outlet, influencer, person of authority or expertise, shall we say. Fear the crowd. Stay away from each other. Do not interact. We are social beings. We have been since the birth of Neanderthal man. There's a great old, I've used this before, the oldest cave painting ever found. I can't remember if it's South America or Portugal. It's pictures of Neanderthals, all with their hands up in the air. And the expert said they are dancing. 20,000 years old, and people were dancing then. It is the essence of human nature to be social, to dance, to enjoy the rhythm of a beat, that drum. Any culture you want, that is what humans have always done, and they banned it. They took that away, and they told us all, you will kill each other if you go and enjoy that. It causes such great mental stress on everybody. There are people for 2 years never got to enjoy that rite of passage to go out on their 18th birthday and their 21st. And then all of a sudden they get to go out and half the place is shut. Restrictions are still in place. You're not allowed to dance more than six people at a time. It's a little bit like, you know, Reese, the movie, and they have the ballroom dance, and the teacher goes up with the ruler and measures how far apart they need to be. It's actually happening. You had to stay a meter away. The impact of that is still felt today when you go out to your normal local place. People still look and they frown upon you, especially those in authority. It sent us back decades. And you say the work you did that built those bridges. It said how great our nighttime economy is, the worth it brings, the vibrancy it generates in cities. Manchester being a prime one. The amount of people who wants to move to Manchester because of its vibrancy of nightlife. And then they closed it down. Residents moved in and then they complained when noise started, when lockdown ended. And the councils upheld them. They're killing the essence of humanity. Our social being and
we
essence.
We know that in Birmingham, just to jump in there, I mean, Birmingham historically has had a really great nightlife. I mean, you know, just in terms of the period during the Acid House and what happened with clubs, I mean, everything from Miss Moneypenny's to the Rainbow Rooms. We've got Digbeth, which is a whole cultural quarter that's been like regenerated for people who are not familiar with Birmingham or the Midlands. And similar things are true of Stoke. And we had Golden in Stoke and lots of areas all across the UK. Actually, many people, you know, people often, some people with football, they get to go to other areas, meet other people. But actually, many people in Britain started travelling much more, not just within Britain, but also internationally, because it became a global culture, global export of dance music that was from Britain and the dance floor, as you say, because some people can sort of trivialise it, but its impact in terms of fashion, in terms of getting the new Stormzy's or Adele's. It's all huge. But I suppose the question now is, Martin, I want to ask you, you know, you were involved in putting together an event that was done in Birmingham, and we also had something over at King's Heath, where the many, you know, hundreds of people came out. They've been challenging the low traffic neighbourhoods, very active, very impressive. And it does seem to be an appetite for people locally to say, this is not acceptable. These are our businesses and our livelihoods and we're residents. People are actually challenging these things across the board, aren't they?
They're challenging them, but they're being ignored. There is no research, public consultation. It's hidden in the back pages of councils' websites. That when they originally pass it, has a couple of hundred people comments, of which those are mainly councillors or people involved in the project. And when it gets taken out to the public, King's Heath did their own survey. I actually have a written copy of it where they went around businesses, each business signed it, they made comments of it. 90%, just over 90% of all businesses objected to the LTN in King's Heath. Over 50% had already lost trade and business since its introduction. These are signed, written comments, an affidavit, if you will. This was handed in and it has still been ignored. It's just, it's disgraceful. They are not listening to the business. If it comes to the nighttime economy, my biggest fear, and I've always said this with LTNs, the 15-minute cities and EULAs, CAS, the LES, there's so many acronyms for these things, but it's all the same thing. They ban traffic from entering an area. Now, for the nighttime economy, it literally will make it more dangerous for those that work and the customers and the public that go out at night. A nighttime economy has just shy of 9 million people working nighttime economy. That's 6 p.m. till 6 a.m. The majority of those actually work in healthcare and social care, our hospitals, our care homes, our night doctors and carers. The next one is hospitality. That's 38.5% of that just shy of 9 million figure. Most of those people are in low paid jobs, not most, but 15.1% are the lowest paid. It's just the roles that are available, your cleaners, your delivery drivers that happen at night. These people have to get to work and get home. But at nighttime, if they can't afford it, Birmingham is £8 to enter the CAS zone. In London, the ULEZ is £12.50. Every night, the vast majority of the UK has no public transport after 11 p.m. And it doesn't really start again until 7 a.m. How are they meant to get to work and back home again safely at night if they are not allowed to drive? We then have customers, our people that go out to our live music venues, to a restaurant, to the opera, to Shakespeare and play, to a local Amdram pub, your school production. How are they to get dropped off and picked back up again if you cannot drive? That dropped off and picked up outside the door of a venue. If the road is blocked, you now have to walk a distance to find where an area where vehicles are allowed. If you do not know the area, you'll use a Google map, which will just take you the shortest routes. And if you're in a big city, probably down a dark alleyway, which anyone will tell you, do not enter that area. You are putting people at risk by not allowing safe transportation at night. And to ban it totally by blocking roads off with no alternative? How do people get there?
This is exactly the question. And when did we ever agree to give up on mobility? I mean, the fact is that, as we know, in all of these areas, the consultations have ignored the responses when they did actually go to people. Often they didn't go to people, but when they did, they ignored the responses. So there's a fundamental question of our democracy. I suppose the thing is, Martin, what would you encourage people to do if they're in any area, they're listening and across the UK or anywhere as it happens, but particularly in the UK, what should people do if they are unhappy about things? You know, you say they're not being listened to, but how do you think, you know, what would your advice be to them in terms of setting up a challenge and doing events or anything, campaigning?
Go to your local council or MP surgeries. They all have them weekly or bi-weekly. And speak face to face, politely, nicely, and logically to them. And then go the following week. And every week, more people will come. Until in the end, their surgery is full just with people asking the same question. You're killing our business. You're making life more dangerous for us. I can't get my children to the after-school club or the sports club at 6, 7 p.m. at night because it's costing me an extra £8 or £12.50 to drive my vehicle. And I'm not having them walk 3 miles home at 7 o'clock at night when it's dark in the winter. This is the out-of-home leisure.
On that note, we're just going to go to a quick break. And if people do want to find out more as well, they can go to Free Our Streets. It's togetherdeclaration.org on the website. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Martin Murray. We're talking about campaigning. Free Our Streets Together. This is TNT Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after the break.
You should hear what Kate Shimarani is talking about.
I was chased down Whitehall in my green cape. Yes, I do wear a cape. There's 3.2 million views on YouTube if you want to watch it. I was in my high heels by hundreds of police. I felt very special. And I was also arrested later outside Parliament. And then I was held in custody for 32 hours. And they used my keys to enter my property with an unsigned warrant. And they took my laptop, kept it for 6 months. But much later, I was then charged with something else. And I didn't go in their court. I just stayed at home, didn't bother. And they had a 5-day trial in the magistrate's court. And I was found guilty of holding these rallies or arranging them, whatever it was at the time, which I didn't do any of it. I just emceed them. So I got convicted and I got 3 fines, 600, 600, 600 and £180 court costs. That's 666 again. Are you smelling it yet, folks? Anyway, Boris and all his mates that the Metropolitan Police provide security for, and it was them that were in court, and all the TSG that came into Parliament Square battering everybody that were there, and they said in court that they were there to get me. They held parties while your loved ones were dying in hospital, but now he's resigned. You know what? I'd like my money back, and I'd like you to wipe those ridiculous charges.
Kate Shimarani on TNT Radio.
Have you ever felt like time was moving too fast? Do you need a break from the hustle and bustle of your daily routine? Then come and experience Sam Sam Yao Noi, where time slows down and magic comes to life on the stunning Yao Noi Island in southern Thailand. Our private villas and public spaces are quiet, spacious, and very inspirational. Inside and outside magic spaces, you'll find exceptional facilities and a full contemporary art collection to inspire your senses. Our dedicated Sam Sam family is here to provide bespoke services to make your stay unforgettable. Let nature and our Sam Sam family team take over, and you'll get the utmost recalibration of your mental balance. Discover the enchantment that awaits you at Sam Sam Yao Noi. Book your stay today at Sam Sam Yao Noi and experience our magic places. Magic spaces for yourself.
Book your stay in Thailand now and visit samsam-spaces.com.
You're listening to The Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Alan Miller, I'm here with Martin Murray, who is an entrepreneur, runs venues, and is passionate about nightlife and the 24-hour cycle in cities, and has also been campaigning with Together to free our streets in the Midlands and across the country. In the last part of what we're talking about, just obviously we've seen a lot of people do things as well, Martin, right? So like in Ealing and Southwark, we've seen that residents have managed to get the local councils to back down and to get rid of low traffic neighbourhoods. We've seen that we've got the government, I think collectively of all the things we've all been doing, we've got the government to stop underwriting financially some of these active travel plans in Liverpool streets and cut the money for these turning roads into cycle pathways, even though some have already occurred. That is a significant change. We need to go much further. I suppose I wonder just what your thoughts are, just in terms of, you know, exciting ways to do it. Obviously, in the whole rave culture and nightlife and entertainment, it's always quite fun and exciting and promotion and marketing. You know, that it seems to me where many more people, because I can tell you, like even where I am in Hackney, they're talking about shutting 75% of the roads. It's gridlock now in a lot of places. But a lot of people in Hackney still don't exactly, they're all talking about it more now, but a lot of people don't know exactly what's going on. I mean, there's going to be trouble when people, if we get to the point where they start trying to do that. But how would you see exciting ways of presenting it, encouraging others to get involved, winning over fellow residents and businesses?
They just think, it's all better. Yes, I've heard something about we want to reduce traffic. Well, that's surely good. It will make it safer for our children to cross the road. And that's what they think it is. They do not realise that very road will become 5 to 10 times bigger because all of the side roads have now been closed. There was an event last week at Villa Park in Birmingham, which is just on the edge of the Essex Expressway as you come off the M6. So we're just outside of the CAS zone, the clean air charge of £8. All the residents are bitching and complaining, stating that the traffic was the busiest they've ever seen, even compared to the largest home games they've ever had, ever. The reason being is that everybody, rather than driving straight to the city, take the wider route around to miss the charges, then all have to enter via one road, causing a mass gridlock. If you're gridlocked, you're causing more pollution. The children can't cross the road if it's permanently filled with traffic because it's not safe. You are doing everything opposite to what they claim will be the result. That was this weekend, the one concert. Imagine it every week for everything you do, forever. It's ridiculous. King's Heath, their traffic to the main high street is now a permanent gridlock because of it. The fumes are dreadful. We're actually speaking to somebody this morning, business owner. He's having to clean the front signage more now than he ever has done because of fumes. He's been there for 20 years. It was never like that. But since in literally less than 12 months, the road is now impassable, this major road, because of the LTN they've put in there. Nobody can cross the road. The second there's any gap, people are frustrated. They just race up, engine the revving, people are getting frustrated. It just caused more pollution because they've blocked roads off.
Absolutely. So Martin, thank you very much for joining us. You can reach Martin. Just tell us how people can get in touch. If they want to get in touch, I'll tell you. You could just get into it. You'll see him on Twitter. He's very, very active. Martin's hashtag is @MartinPMurray. Martin's one of the ambassadors for Together around the country. We've got local hubs and regional groups of people that are campaigning. They're engaging locals. We're putting on events around the country. We've got an event coming up with people in Bristol on the 6th of July, and then in Edinburgh at the end of July. There'll be more information on that. But, Bristol, last week, we covered that on the show. Very important, these local challenges. We've seen that in Oxford in the Cowley Road. We've also seen that in King's Heath, in Birmingham. We've seen it in Bath, where the Ring of Steel was put up and people have been challenging it, in Canterbury and elsewhere. And as per the conversation with Phil Mullen in the first hour of the show, ordinary people, citizens, residents, businesses, our friends, family, neighbours, all the people they sometimes treat as the great unwashed, the technocrats, the managerial technocrats that like to fly in jets, in bulletproof cars internationally and tell us to stop driving and not go on holiday as much and give us lots of instructions about how to live our lives when they don't seem to come up with any ideas about how to transform the things they can have some, they should have a relationship to, which is infrastructure, delivery of services. And we're seeing it in Hackney. There's going to be some more big news in Hackney. I think they think, Mete Choban and others, that it's just a slam dunk. Philip Glanville thinks that, the mayor of Hackney. It ain't happening that way. And let me tell you, soon you're going to see some more things happening. But just now turning to some of these things, when we're told it's permanent crisis or terrible emergency and we've all got to do this, within everything, what one would hope for, what we should have is a culture in a free society where you have different political views, but also you have news reporting. So you have news reporting of the news, of the facts, and then investigative journalism, or at least asking some questions about things. And we saw a lack of that, a paucity of that in the last 3 years. We've seen that. We saw news conferences akin to war press briefings where the whole message was controlled. The only questions were, why are you not going further, quicker, faster, longer, harder? I did not see anyone from Talk TV or GB News, and I didn't hear questions from journalists that would ask more penetrating questions about why are we even locking down? What about the harms, collateral damages, impacts across the board to health, to society, to the economy, to children, to families, to jobs, to everything? All the things, surprise, surprise, we're now seeing roll out now. Predictably by some of us. And there were obviously people like Professor Carol Sikora and others who talked about these impacts to cancer and stroke and heart disease and the health service itself. And one person who's been covering this throughout the period is Lucy Johnson from The Express, because Lucy has consistently been writing about some of these issues, the impacts, and she's very kindly taken a moment out of an enormously busy schedule to talk to us today, and I'm very thankful. Lucy, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Yes, very well, thank you. It's great to be on. Thank you for inviting me.
Just, I suppose what I wanted to do, Lucy, is just, you know, we're seeing a lot of things come out. We saw it with the Twitter files, then with the lockdown files of the Telegraph and other things, and you know, Isabel Oakeshott and the WhatsApp messages and everything. But even without that, right, even without that, there was a sense, wasn't there, that the whole thing that was happening with the media was that it was very lacking in penetration. We had these nightly press conferences where we just saw really terrifying death stats, death numbers. They were never contextualized, how many people dying of cancer normally or heart disease a day or a week or a month or a year, excess deaths, none of that. Just, this is the thing. And it just seemed like there was this kind of almost for a while, complete lack of any challenge. The only challenge was go further, go harder. I mean, why do you think that in a place where we sort of pride ourselves on having a sort of gobby, quite strong kind of journalistic tradition, that would be the case?
Well, it is really interesting. And I think a lot of conspiracy theorists blame lockdown reasoning on the mainstream media, and they sort of see it as the propaganda arm of the government. But I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. You had the chief medical officer, you had the government, who just sort of had a get out of jail free card by saying, well, we're following the science, and then divesting all its decisions apparently to the sage scientists. And you had also a feverish population that had been fed a lot of images from social media and elsewhere of people in Hamzat suits and, you know, mass graves. And I think there was a huge appetite and a fear that had already been whipped up, and it was very difficult to actually contradict that. You know, the chief medical officer, the government, and the group of scientists elected to make decisions are all saying, you know, this is a serious threat, up to 500,000 people could die. you know, the easiest thing for a journalist to do is sort of play safe and follow that. I however, having said that, I am very surprised that journalists didn't do more to look at the harms of what might unfold, which, as you've just rightly pointed out, are, you know, unfolding now, and it's catastrophic. And I think that is partly because of the very nature of news journalism, which always, you know, pandemics are newsworthy, they're deadly, they're rare. And, you know, the only story in town was COVID. So at the time, it was, a good story, and it was one that would, get the headlines.
So, I mean, I get the headlines and I get eyeballs, and I know that in the new age of digital, you know, that newspapers are struggling, although they've got to become kind of entertainment companies. But, you know, I hear what you're saying, that it was all around this thing. But I mean, you say conspiracy theorists say this, but I mean, there is a question about why it was that so quickly this spread. I mean, it's a very interesting question about our susceptibility to fear, our sense of concern. I mean, we know that, and you've written about this and you featured it in your own podcast, the kind of nudge unit, the behavioural psychology's insights team that were there to terrify the public. The, you know, Matt Hancock saying we wanted to scare the pants off everyone. That would be seen as a concerted effort, as a conscious decision. You don't even have to call it a conspiracy. I mean, you just said that was just what happened, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And anxiety spreads faster than any virus. It did happen, and I think that, I actually found out yesterday that I was part of, or being watched by the government under its disinformation unit, having sent a freedom of information request. You know, everything I write, you know, I have to copper bottom it for accuracy. So it was interesting that I was being watched, because our paper was unusual in that our editor did allow us to look behind those headlines and look behind that fear. And I think you're right. And I think the answer, I mean, I still think about it, you know, regularly, because it is confusing, but I think it's complicated. I don't think there's any one party or person to blame, but in fact, it was a perfect storm of politics, health and money. So you had a lot of people being funded to do COVID research. You keep looking for things, you keep looking for variants, and you keep finding them. You had politicians whose role, really, or their main aim, is to hold on to power. And we had, and they were trying to please the public, which was also frightened. They were divesting their decision-making to this group of scientists. And crucially, the decision-making was given to a group of scientists who are doctors. They are biomedical people. So their priority in life is to save every life. It's for disease and to prevent disease. Actually, under the original plans, the pandemic response was to be run from our cabinet office. So it would have had people looking at the economy, people looking at education, people looking at psychology. The plan was to keep things going, but for some reason, and this has been blamed on years of underfunding and cuts, that plan was lost in the organizational memory, and we gave all the control, really, of this narrative to the scientists who were run under the Department of Health. And therefore, control of the response was all about prevention of disease. But actually, as we know, mental ill health, poverty, all the things we're seeing now are also deadly. And we don't really know how we're going to, you know, I don't know how many years it will take, possibly generations, before we see some recovery for some of the damage that's been done.
It's, you covered it in an article. One of the things you covered, I mean, obviously the 7 million waiting on the NHS, the A&E situation, the doctors, the whole thing, as well as what you talk about, you know, years of, I would also say, inefficiency and a bureaucratic top-down approach that doesn't get the most efficient way of dealing with things. But also, as you reported, there were 67,000, nearly 68,000 extra deaths in England and Wales from April 2022 until April 2023, which is 12, nearly 13% above the pre-pandemic five-year average. And only a quarter of them were attributed to COVID in any way. So the rest were all related to non-COVID causes. And, you know, and you've also written, of course, about people not being at work and initiatives trying to get people into work that are ill, health, sick. We've got this situation now. Before we go to the break, how would you like to have seen the relationship between the government, you talked about that in the cabinet and what should be done, and the media, like in the future, if he was going to get something into the COVID inquiry and make that point to them, or how, what do you think should be the de facto expectation?
That we have that any response to a pandemic should be run with many different parties involved. Not just doctors. Doctors are there to, you know, their aim is to save lives, save every life at every cost. That's what doctors do. But actually, if you'd had people who understood about the economy, people who understand about education, about children, you need a whole host of vested interests in running a response. Because the vested interests of the scientists, either for research funding or just their belief system, is that we must save every life at every cost. But actually, that's impossible to do because, you know, you need money in the economy for the health service. You need, you know, you can't function if you're just running things in that way. So that would be one thing. I think the pandemic, the briefings were also taken by largely political journalists who were looking for gotcha moments to have a go at the government. Why haven't you got more PPE? Why haven't you got more ventilators? Which actually were killing people. That's what they were doing. They were trying to get headlines, but actually there were very few health and scientific editors in those press briefings asking deeply about the questions and about the decisions. Why do you think there'll be 500,000 deaths, which was the modelling predicting, you know, way out, and what, you know, what could be the harms, and what does this mean? They weren't there to answer those questions. So I think two things from the get-go. But the inquiry, in fact, you know, will look at what lawyer-led inquiries are very good looking at what happened, but not why they happened. Why did we have a lockdown at all? That was never in the plan, and not many journalists even questioned that. And that does need to be examined because it was an experiment. And in Sweden, they didn't do it. Well, it was a very light lockdown. And in fact, I went out to Sweden and asked the architect of its pandemic response, why are you not doing this? And Anders Tegnell said to me, because I'm following the science. Following the novel virus, you identify those who are at risk and you protect those. I've no idea what a lockdown will do to our children who are already suffering with mental health problems, to our education, to people with hip problems, to the economy as a whole. That is an experiment and I'm not doing it. So that was really interesting. And we didn't ask those questions.
Well, I'm here with Lucy Johnson. She's the Health and Social Affairs Editor of the Sunday Express. And I'm Alan Miller, and this is TNT Radio. Join us just after this break. Stay with us, please.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Our Constitution is under attack, and the Bill of Rights is hanging by a thread. What's worse is that the malefactors subverting the Republic hold positions of trust within our very government. How many of them are there legitimately by popular expression of the will of we the people remains uncertain. If you seek to implement a bloodless coup, overthrow a government, and tear down a nation, you must first make certain that you've got the right number of people in the right positions. What is certain is that they have access to the levers of power and are operating them to their benefit and our detriment. Start with a politicized and weaponized DOJ FBI to plant evidence of crimes that were never committed, withhold exculpatory evidence from innocent defendants, and actively cover up crimes committed by those who share your ideology. Next, add in the uniparty control of Congress, as evidenced by the 20 disgraceful Republicans in the House of Representatives who voted to table the motion to censure one of the biggest criminals in Congress, bug-eyed Burbank Bolshevik Adam Schiff, and worse, the two even more spineless jellyfish that voted present. Finally, mix in just the right number of compromised judges in just the right courts to dismiss any cases alleging election tampering while simultaneously hearing cases based on illegally obtained indictments of your political enemies. What way forward? Hit your knees and pray for God's mercy. Then get out there and fight like hell, using their own tactics against them. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The Associated Press reported that tax findings for fiscal 2020 by the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation list millions of dollars paid to entities controlled by relatives and close associates of then-executive director and co-founder Patrice Cullors. The IRS filings, the first and only public disclosure of the Black Lives Matter Foundation's finances, show that the non-profit took $76,872,002 in fiscal 2020, mainly in donations from corporate backers and individuals, and paid out $25,997,945 in grants to other non-profits and contractors. Cullors, the only board member listed on the 63-page filing, resigned as executive director in June 2021. She did so just weeks after 2 months of victims of police violence released a statement demanding that BLMGNF stop exploiting the deaths of their children to make money. The same month as the mother's statement was published, the New York Post revealed that Cullors and her wife had purchased four properties worth approximately $3 million between 2016 and 2021.
Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. I was just talking with Lucy, who was given a very good insight into what the problems were. And actually, Lucy, in your background, you're now at the Sunday Express, but you were assistant editor at The Observer as well and at The Big Issue. I just wonder, a bit like the COVID inquiry terms, it does seem that it's strange, isn't it? Because you went to Sweden and you talk about Angus Tegnell, and there we've got a country that was sort of seen. I know things have changed in the whole social democracy model in the last sort of decade or so, but it is seen much more as that kind of left-leaning nation. There's a long history of its relationship to the state and the people, and they took a very different approach. They would only send one child home if they're at school, and they, as you say, you know, they could have 50 people in a gathering. And yet over here and in America, it seemed like those that were more associated with what you would have called the left, I know these terms are difficult now, were much more demanding that more should go. I mean, certainly The Guardian seemed to be a champion of these things, as well as some others on Sky, you know, Beth Bigby and others. I'm not asking you to get into conflict with other journalists, but I'm just asking on your reflections of why that might be, from your point of view.
Well, it is very, very interesting, and you did see that, and it became very tribal, in fact, and then those sort of tribes took a left and right sort of cloak, really, and it became very aggressive. I mean, some of it may be that people wanted to, or the left-leaning papers wanted to criticise the current conservative government, and so it would be an easy hit to just have a go at Boris Johnson for not doing enough, and, you know, for papers to portray him as unfit for office. But having said that, many conservative newspaper titles were doing the same thing and being very pro-lockdown. And maybe many of those thought that that Prime Minister Boris Johnson was unfit for office, so it was an opportunity to have a go at him. But at the same time, I think you're right in that there were lots of groups that sprang up. There was also a group we had called Independent Sage. So it was named after the official group of scientists who were advising the government. But they were a left-leaning, I think, bunch of people who were pushing for harder and stronger lockdowns. And a lot of journalists I know would pick up on what on their podcasts and on their video recordings and on their press releases, which called for a more autocratic and more Chinese-style lockdown. And one sort of questions, you know, whether it did become a political fight. You know, it lost the, you know, the science was really lost, in fact, and it just became a fight between different ideologies, which when you think about science, you know, following the science, there's no such thing. Science, it relies on discourse and debate, and it's ever evolving. That's the whole point of science. But during this period, we almost saw the death of science, because you couldn't, or people were pilloried for questioning the prevailing narrative, and they were shut down. And in fact, as you know, Alan, you know, we saw a lot of posts on social media that were actually taken down, even though they had been put together. There were research papers by respected scientists themselves, by professors at Stanford, Oxford, and elsewhere. So it was a very strange time, and one has to really question how whether the government collaborated with big tech and social media to keep this one voice, this one narrative that sort of put the pandemic response on a war footing. You know, we just have one narrative and we all have to follow it.
It's shocking, isn't it, that you as a journalist and that we as citizens have had a spy unit, two spy units, in fact, the Rapid Response Unit in the cabinet that is now closed down, but the thing that's still in existence, the disinformation unit, the CDU, sounds like something from East Europe or the Soviet Cold War times. It's chilling, a terrible situation that our journalists could be spied on, our citizens could be spied on, have things suppressed, censored, shadow banned. And, you know, it'd be great if you published that. I'm not sure if we're going to put it out there and everything, but we'd all love to see that for sure, Lucy. I suppose the question is about how we all insist and make sure that we don't see a situation like that again, because we had a pandemic preparedness strategy, didn't we? That got jettisoned. We've now got a discussion that the World Health Organization, on the one hand, is talking about a new treaty, new amendments. And we had our own Public Health Act that was used to implement lockdowns, which could be done just as easily again. So there are many areas where, you know, and even the COVID inquiry, it seems like its point of reference, and certainly the things it's going on about having lateral flow tests even now, it's just astonishing. But it seems that its position is that the terms were much more about, well, should the lockdowns have happened sooner and should they have gone on for longer? And, you know, did people not act toughly enough? So there's a lot of things that still need to be addressed, aren't there? And this is also at a point where some people understandably are just like, I don't want to talk or think about all of that. It was terrible. And I've got loads of cost of living issues to face up.
I've lost you.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, just in this latter part of the show, how you know, what's your thoughts on how, you know, the public or people who are concerned about this can actually, you know, how would you see that? Obviously, you're a journalist. It's a different thing. But you saw what was going on. You saw there were challenges. You also saw there were protests. You wrote about some of the things. What do you think, as a point of view of a citizen as well, could be done to have things done differently, the lessons that can be learned, and how you know, the things we still face up to, like around the whether it's WHO or our own Public Health Act and measures within that, and how decisions are made and scrutiny, cost benefit analysis, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea, because I do think it could quite easily happen again. And that is the playbook now. And as you've seen and said, the World Health Organization is again talking about masks, social distancing and lockdowns for future pandemics. And we still don't know whether or how far these actually were effective in reducing deaths. But what we do know is that they caused so much harm. And as you've referred to earlier, we now have excess levels of, or pandemic levels of excess non-COVID deaths. And that's happening all over the world, including New Zealand and including Australia, I believe. So, you know, something, you know, one could say that that seems to be linked to lockdowns. And this is not being taken into account. And the only thing that I feel is that people have to speak up. And during that whole period, it was heartbreaking to see how those brave scientists who did speak up, who helped me and other journalists inform our opinions, you know, or widen our opinions and look at things differently, how they were shut down, how they were pilloried, they were vilified, they were silenced, and as you said, shadow banned. And had they not spoken up, had they not been brave, and had some of the people like you, Alan, not stood up and said, look, this is wrong, or can we question this, then you would be in isolation. And that's all I think is important. You know, if you think something doesn't sound right or doesn't feel right or you question it, speak up, because there will probably be many other people who feel the same or are not sure, but they would like to learn more. So that's the only thing I can think, because ultimately politicians are accountable to their constituents. And if constituents, you know, our lockdowns were really popular, had they not been so popular, they may not have gone on so long, and they may not have indeed happened at all. So that's how I would, you know, apart from changing the way decisions are made and not through the narrow lens of the biomedical, the doctor community, those particular scientists, you know, you need a wider spread of scientists, sociologists, economists. Apart from that, I think individuals need to speak up, and they need to join together, and they need to say, no, no, this is wrong. I think that's the only way to fight it, really.
Well, just how much do you think there are similarities between the we're at an precipice, terrible crisis? I mean, there was once in a lifetime pandemic, we thought. You've mentioned there are future pandemics being warned to us down the pipeline, but also the seemingly endless evolving crisis, permanent state of emergency, that is the discussion about the environment. I mean, is it a similar context from a journalistic point of view about asking questions, being sceptical, then being branded as something sort of beyond the pale or a denier? Or what's got, you know, and from a journalistic point of view, how do you see that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually. I mean, interestingly, the pandemics of we had pandemics of a similar order of magnitude. 1957, we had the Asian flu, and 1968, we had Hong Kong flu. And I looked it up, and they were of a similar order. And we had press coverage then. The dangers were acknowledged, but they weren't overblown. And I think the digital era and this 24/7 news cycle, and the way that that has polarized people into groups, and even people who are not very, you know, not specialists in the area, influencers who want to get likes and want to get clicks and want to get attention, are sort of joining into different bandwagons. It's become a battle of ideologies rather than a battle of, you know, seeking what is the truth and what are the real answers. I think the climate debate is also very interesting. I'm no specialist in this area at all, but I have spoken to people, to scientists who question some of the modelling around the climate science, and they can't get their voices out there anywhere. And there's this idea that there is a consensus. But as soon as we start saying things like the science is settled, then we have to start asking ourselves, well, you know, I become skeptical, because the whole point of science is that it isn't ever settled. It's always being explored and evolved. That's how you define it. So, but in this, you know, for journalists, it's very difficult when you have so many important sounding institutions and leading figures saying one thing. You have to have a very good reason to say something very different, and you have to have very good evidence too.
Thank you so much, Lucy Johnson. We hope to get you back again. Look forward to reading some more. You can see Lucy at the Sunday Express and at the Lucy Johnson. I'm Alan Miller. Big shout out to everyone challenging the ULEZ in Edmonton. Next week's the big one in London Marble Arch, June 25th. Make sure everyone comes down for that. And I will see you next week. I'll be in New York. And I look forward to speaking to you all then. Stay free, keep questioning, make sure we have our freedoms. It's all about that. I'm Alan Miller, this is TNT Radio. We'll see you real soon.